This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and wonderful and oh so curious friends. You are looking fantastic today. My name is Jadley, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, and other experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Right now, please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the Admiral of Adventure, the Dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jed. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you, my friend?
I am so excited about today's episode. We are going to talk about engineering.
Engineering. Yes, yes, yes. This is going to be a great time. I can't wait to find out what we're going to solve today.
Well, spin the wheel.
Here we go.
Why would you want to break a flying car?
Why would you want to break a flying car? Do flying cars even exist? And why would you want to break one?
Well, do they exist? The prototype stage, which means they're just starting to work on and build them. But who knows, down the road, wouldn't that be cool?
Cool and scary, yeah.
Well, we have on our show today aeronautical engineer Anthony Hazlett to tell us all about how he worked on a flying car.
This is awesome. Welcome to Solve It for Kids, Anthony.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited. I'll tell you, typically when folks want to talk to engineers, it's because something's gone wrong and they I'm in trouble. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm really excited to share some of the stuff I've been able to work on so far, in my job and my career and, where I went to school and how all that's played out over the last few years. So really excited. And this seems like a really fun podcast.
Yeah, I think we would love to hear kind of like your story. Like, how did you start? Did you always want to be an engineer or, kind of what your path was?
Yeah, so that's always a really fun question. And it's something that, forgive me in advance, because I could talk about it for a really long time. So I always, growing up, I always had, a thought. I always had the want to work on airplanes and want, right? And so, my family, we weren't a bunch of pilots or anything like that. We didn't grow up in cornfields in the middle of, Ohio or whatnot, where a lot of actual aerospace celebrities, if you will, have started, right? Actually, my uncle was a Ball turret gunner in World War II in a B-17.
Oh, and wow.
Words to say, he served in the Air Force. And he was actually shot down. He was fighting for the Allies, shot down in Germany, and he was a POW. He was a prisoner of war.
Oh, my gosh.
He spent some time in an unfriendly place, not by his choice. But anyway, so I grew up learning about him. Unfortunately, he passed away before I was born. But, we had all these, the family had all these memories that they would share. And it always focused around him and his service in the Air Force. And the Air Force is the branch of the U.S. military that does a lot of flying and a lot of aircraft development. So I learned a lot about World War II aviation, learned, growing up, and it was always fascinating to me. I said, I want to work on planes. First, I did say I want to fly planes. To be a very good pilot, you need to have very good eyesight.
And yes.
I was best in line for eyesight. See the broad side of a barn, which is true, but I still can drive.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, there you go. So being a pilot was sort of out of the question, but I, happened to be somewhat good at math and physics, not as good as other folks in high school. But I kept going down the path of wanting to work on airplanes. So became an engineer, followed that schooling path. And then I did, during college, I went to a community college first, which is a great way. I really advocate for that. It's a great way to save some money. Going out and going to a four-year school. So I went to community college, and then I transferred to another university to finish my degree in aerospace engineering. And then while I was at college, I did two what you call internships, where you go work for a company for a short period.
Right.
That company was called GE Aviation, General Electric Aviation. They make jet engines.
Yeah.
They also make light bulbs and fridges and certain radios. So that
Of course, that all goes together. Jet engines, all goes together. Light bulbs.
Yeah, it all hangs together. You know, if you make one, you can make anything. A jet engine, a toaster. So, you know, they, large company founded here in America, and jet engines are the things that are most typically seen underneath the wings of very big airplanes.
Right, exactly. And they do some stuff
to some air and then exhaust it out of the back. So I did two internships with them, and I guess I did something right because they offered me a job. I started working there. I worked there for a handful of years and then went off to work for a flying car company, which is just what it sounds like. like an airplane, but drives like a vehicle. And then, you know, now I'm back with the same, with the same jet engine manufacturer. And, you know, it's just a statement that you never know where your career is sort of going to go in even a short amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I look at it this way. You got to work on a flying car.
Yeah.
To me, this is so cool. So tell us, you know, what your job was. I mean, were you involved in the design or were you more, you know, like, can you go through the different steps of, you know, so there's design and then there's what, testing and.
Yep. So in my career and, you know, in my life, I've worked in design, I've worked in test, I've worked in, you know, validation, right? So I've sort of seen the entire process. At the flying car company, I worked in specifically in test, and the way come up the role of a test engineer is my job was to try and break somebody's design intentionally. I got paid to break things.
Oh, that is so cool. I mean, that's not something that kids think about, but that is specifically the job of a design engineer is to break it.
It's to break it, right? We want to put something together, right? You know, that meets the requirements. And then the designer, you want to demonstrate that you've created the best design, which typically means it doesn't break. And so, you know, what you want to do is you've got to have somebody who's going to have a novel way of trying to break something in its most simplest terms to see, you know, did that design engineer do the best, you know, job with what they had available. So
does that become like a competition, you know, between the designer and the tester?
To be quite honest, we sometimes joked about that. We said, you know, if I can't, you know, in our group, so I managed a team of 14, you know, engineers and pilots. And I would say, you know, if we can't figure out a way to break it, you probably did a good job, right? but if we did find a way to break it, then you owe me lunch. So test engineering, it's actually funny, right? You know, for something that seems so regimented as the engineering field, right? You know, test engineering, really, it's typically a destructive process, right?
Oh.
It's as simple as, you know, taking something and trying to bend it and see if it breaks, or pulling on it and seeing if it breaks, to taking a full automobile and crashing it into a wall, right?
Oh.
One is very expensive, one's not so expensive, one takes a lot of time to set up right, and one doesn't. So, but that's sort of the range of things I did over at the flying car company.
So how big was this flying car? Was it just two people, or how many people did it hold?
Yeah, so the flying car, the prototype, and then what would have been the production version held two people.
Next to each other.
So what side by side, you know, not single file. So not tandem, but side by side. And, so it held two people and it was, you know, it was, if you've seen a sports car, right. You know, a very small, compartment, driver's compartment, that's equivalent to what this would have looked like.
Okay.
So the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Administration, they're the folks that work in the United States to govern how all the different vehicles either get certified for use in the air and how people use the airspace above the United States. They have pretty strict requirements for how big a specific type of airplane can be. So our flying car could only be a certain amount, and it could only be, you know, a certain length or hold a certain number of people, right? Too many people, and it becomes more like a commercial airplane, right? Too heavy and too overpowered. If it has a big enough engine, it becomes a different class of airplane. And we're trying to design something that, you know, you or I could go get a license to fly in under 40 hours.
Oh, wow.
40 hours about, right, you know, give or take, and basically be able to be certified to drive this on the road, go to an airport, and then, you know, take off, if you will.
So, okay, so it was designed to take off from an airport, not just like driving down the road and all of a sudden you're up in the air.
So, unfortunately, you couldn't just take off from the highways. I will say it's not as if there aren't vehicles or airplanes out there that can't land or take off from roads, you know, if there was an emergency or whatnot. So anyway, on this flying car, it held two people. It had a steering wheel, which is very unique for an airplane. And then, it had enough space to fit a few suitcases to go away on a weekend trip or a thing of golf clubs. Right, so that was part of setting the requirements of the vehicle, right?
Now, was your airplane, was it like a prop plane or like a helicopter? How did it get up in the air?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So the primary means of propulsion, meaning the device that pushed the airplane in the air was a propeller. And it was a little gas engine on the back of it. So we had a pusher prop configuration, pusher propeller, which sounds sort of just like what it means. There was a propeller that was pushing the aircraft. A lot of airplanes, you see the propeller on the front of the vehicle, and it would, if you will, pull it through the air.
Right.
In this instance, the propeller was pointed the opposite direction. So it was on the back end of the aircraft, right? And it would push it down the runway, and you get air over the wings, right? And that creates lift, which lifts the airplane up off the ground. A little unique. Not a lot of airplanes have a propeller pointed in the opposite direction. Some do, but it's not typically, it's a little bit interesting to make it that way.
So where are the wings when you're driving the car?
Yeah, so they're folded. They would be, so in the flying car, the wings were folded up against the body.
Outside, right?
Yep. So if you think about, if you see an airplane at the airport, right, there are two wings that, that stick out on the other side of the fuselage.
Right.
Pretty hard to drive down the highway with a wingspan, right?
Hey, nobody would cut you off, though, right?
Nobody would cut you off. Yeah. You might also take off, too, depending on how fast you were going. So we had to fold those wings. So we had the founders of the company had come up with these nifty hinges that you could basically pull the wings together and fold them up to the body. Now, the flip side is, like every design decision you make, there's a compromise.
Yes.
So, having your wings folded close to the body meant sort of two things. One, sometimes a little hard to see because you've got these two big wings behind you that are sort of crowding your vision on your peripheral. And also, the tips of the wings, right, are sort of close to the ground. So, ground clearance becomes somewhat of an issue, right? Yeah, could be a little challenging. So that's something the design team had to take into consideration when they were working through the different shapes and styles of the wings that they were trying to use. All these little things, that add up to forcing the design to be one type or another, if you will.
Right. And then, so what about, what are some other things? Like, you had to think about the weight, overall weight of getting this thing up in the air, right?
Yeah, that was a real challenge. So the FAA, they said that an aircraft that weighs less than 1,300 pounds could be considered a light sport aircraft, which basically meant that somebody could fly it with less hours of training than it takes to fly a full, a full-size, typical general aviation aircraft. So it meant it would be easier to get your license.
Right.
So we wanted to appeal to the largest audience as possible. So in that design, they basically said, all right, 1,300 pounds was the goal weight. Now, the aircraft ended up getting a little heavier, and there's ways that you can get what are called exemptions, or you get the FAA to change the requirement on the design. And one of the biggest challenges was how to create a vehicle that was safe to drive on the road should you get into an accident, right? So cars, are about 3,000, 3,500 pounds.
Yes.
And a lot of that is in the frame of the vehicle, right? Yep. It ends up taking up the energy when you get into an accident. The other portion of the weight is the engine and then the seats and the inside. But the frame of the vehicle is typically somewhat heavy. And in our vehicle, it had to be very light, which meant it was a challenge to try to design a strong vehicle, which was also light. So that 1,300 pounds is actually, you know, it's pretty tough to meet. You know, there are, you know, motorcycles that weigh maybe 400 or 500 pounds. But, you know, there are some, you know, sport cars that weigh, you know, 2,000, 2,200 pounds. So 1,300 is definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's mind-boggling. There's so many different things to consider. It's like, I want a flying car. Okay, how do we do that? We get the wings and the propellers. Oh, but if you fold up the wings, it hits the ground, and you got to think of how do you keep all those things straight in your head?
90% of the job is knowing what's being asked of you. So what are the requirements? And so what does that, you know, what does that actually mean? Well, if you know, if you lay out a plan, right, really in well detail, and that's easy to understand and say, here's the problem I'm trying to solve, then, you know, I believe the problem is half solved at that point, right?
Yeah.
You know, I need a plane that drives on the road that can, you know, fold its wings, so on and so forth. You go down the, you know, the line of thought that says, here are all the things I think I'm going to need to take into consideration, right? It becomes, it almost solves itself, right? Because you start, it makes, you know, the plan starts making decisions for you.
Well, it's kind of like a funnel, right? Like you start with a big wide, here's your thing. And then as you add each of those in, you kind of, the edges kind of come together until you end up down at the end of the funnel. And you're like, well, this is what I have to create. And then the big question is can I?
Can I create? Yeah, exactly. So you've got it absolutely, you know, absolutely spot on.
So did you break the design? You know, you said that was your job, is to set out and break the design and show that there are issues with it. Were you able to do that?
I am happy to report in the two instances, so in twice in my career, I've worked in the test field, once at GE and once at Terrafugia, and I'll be happy to report in both instances, we've broken something. We've found the design, you know, was lacking in some requirement. And it was great because you understand what the limits of the current design are. And then immediately you typically ask, well, what can I do to fix it, right? And, you know, you and the design engineer are working together and you're saying, well, this is how it broke and this is what happened. So now we're going to go back and fix it. And it's actually a great moment, right? Because you get to understand, here are all the assumptions I made to meet these requirements. And I made this thing and the thing didn't quite work the way I wanted it to. So now I get to understand, well, maybe I made a poor assumption or maybe something worked differently than, you know, we thought it was. So what we call a boundary condition would need to be applied slightly differently.
Right. And
when you get to a product that you or I are using, it's what we would call well-tested.
Exactly.
Anthony, I'm wondering, how long did it take you because when we're growing up, I mean, I'm still growing up, and I still think, I got to win. I got to do it right every single time. But, you know, you're like, it failed. I broke it. And that's a good thing. How long did it take you to kind of change the way you were thinking?
Yeah. So that's a really good question, actually. And, you know, I'm not sure when it happens, but I think it certainly comes, you know, comes as a learned trait, right? A lot of the things that we do today, especially as the world sort of starts moving faster and faster and faster, we want to do more and more and more. And to do more and more and more, you end up wanting to do things more, you know, right. You know, sometimes you're, you know, failure is not an option. And then, you know, what I will say to that is, you know, real learning, I think what I've come to appreciate only comes when, you know, to be quite honest, you screw something up, right? You messed up, right?
So in a way, you know, we always talk about police officers and firefighters and lifeguards being heroes and saving people's lives. In a way, engineers are doing that. You know, when they're going out and they say, oh, this isn't going to work. We don't want this toaster that's going to blow up in someone's kitchen.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a specific creed associated with engineering. And certainly, you know, there's certainly an upper echelon that I maybe one day will be able to see the inside of. You know, I'm just sort of looking up at those great engineers of our society. But you look at the folks, and you see this more in terms of civil engineering specifically, right? And so, you know, folks might grow up thinking that, well, it's easy to design a building, right? We've been doing it for 200 years. It's sort of boring. But it's that, you know, skyscrapers are becoming more and more complex with more and more demand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of them, you know, they don't want them to be vertical, you know, straight up and down. They want them to be these cool kind of
shapes and curves.
Different shapes, or let's just make the building go in and then up and then out again. And you have to think about support.
And then you look at transportation, airplanes, right? The folks that work on making airplanes flying, right? Safety, and making airplanes fly reliably, fly safe. Same thing with trains, you know, high-speed train travel.
Right.
Dangerous, right? Because you're crossing through cities. I'll start with some level of engineering behind that, life-saving devices and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Look at the healthcare industry, and it's wrought with engineering's all over the place, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what I want to know is what happened to the flying car. Will we all be driving them soon?
Yeah, so if you look back, you know, one of my favorite articles somebody sent me was a Popular Mechanics ad, which was, you know, hey, where's my flying car, right? We sort of had the notion with the Jetsons, right? That was a car.
Yeah, exactly. We're still waiting.
I think it's on its way, but it's tough, right? And it's tough for really three specific reasons. Flying cars are they're a challenge to make within the requirements that are put out for them. So they're a challenge to make, and they're a challenge to make at a price that's affordable for, you know, you and I, right?
Right.
Something that is both a car and an airplane, if it costs $500,000 or $1 million, it doesn't help. You know, we can't leverage that to its fullest potential, right? We
can
look at it and see, you know, see that it's a technology that's out there. So one, making it affordable and making them reliable. You know, two, I think, you know, the general public, you know, accepting it, right? There's a small group of us that are like, yes, let's get flying cars. It's gonna be But I think if you ask more folks, at least some of the feedback I got was along the lines of a flying car, that's sort of nuts, right? And the reason is because you think about how many people will say, well, how many car accidents there are on the road? You're going to have this influx of the, you know, of airplanes in the air.
Well, there's no roads, so there's no stop signs, so there's no, I mean, also, how high are the flying cars flying?
So the general service ceiling is up to 10,000 feet. So it's zero to 10,000 feet altitude, you know, adjusted for
gravity. So they're not up at 30,000 feet with all the jets.
With all the jets. No, they couldn't, you know, the physics behind the engine they're using and the wings, you know, they couldn't get up to that altitude, right? So that's certainly number two is, you know, just sort of I'll say the acceptability of flying cars as an actual transportation. You know, somebody asked a really great question at one of the trade shows that I was at representing the company is, you know, they asked somebody, they said, would you ever put your child in there? They were asking was honest and said, well, I don't know. I don't know if I would right now. Right. And it's a testament to, you know, there's things internally to the way we think and what we perceive as being acceptable and not.
Yeah.
A portion of it are the regulations, right? All the regulations and the logistics, right, are tough because now you've got an influx of people, you know, with these flying cars that are going to either be, you know, how do you insure a flying car, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's... Flying car. You know, do you have too many people at first, so you need to weed it out a little bit more? You know, what happens when there's a high rate or a high spike in you know, accidents or whatnot? So it's a challenge on many fronts, and so I think, you know, a good alternative that we saw, you know, history has a funny way of repeating itself in the 70s, you know, specific to, you know, the problem flying cars were trying to solve, which was making air mobility, so the ability to move by air more affordable or more accessible for you and I. You know, helicopters are a really great way of doing that. Certainly, we're not going to go out and pilot a helicopter. I mean, unless, of course, you guys have your pilot's license.
Right, exactly.
But you look at New York City in the 70s, and there were charter helicopter services that would go from sort of building top to building top. There was one really bad accident, though. A few people, unfortunately, lost their lives, and that ended up leading, you know, maybe not directly, but certainly indirectly to the end of charter helicopter travel building to building or airport to building. And so there's a certain public safety perception that was enough to drive relatively sustainable business out of, you know, out of, you know, I'll say out of profitability.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are so many things that you have to, I mean, I learned about this when, you know, when I did my Save the Crash Test Dummies book, where about how they do car crash tests and all this kind of stuff. And they do what, you know, thousands of them, and they get all of this data and then they crunch it back to figure out. And now they have dummies of different sizes. And you know, that's stuff that you guys all have to think about in the flying cars, you know. Do we have, you know, a grown man who might weigh 200 pounds and maybe his child who is only like 50 pounds? And then like, because how do you balance that weight when you're going up in the air? And is that something that you need to be concerned about? And these are all cool things. I think that engineers, like most of us don't even think about it, but there's so many moving parts to designing something that, you know, I hope the kids can get excited about this. Maybe, you know, maybe you've inspired them, Anthony. They can go, you know, our listeners, take out your piece of paper and start writing down what you'd put in your flying car, right?
What you put in your, that's how it starts, right?
How would you draw it? Would it be cool? Would you try to make it like a helicopter and put the, you know, the propeller on top, or, you know, all these different things? But I think this is something that we can leave with our listeners, is that, you know, being an engineer is actually really cool, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, the thing I learned most about talking with you tonight, Anthony, is what you said earlier on, is that one of the most important things you can do as an engineer is listen to what the problem is.
Yes.
And if you listen and you understand what's being asked of you, then you solved half of the problem.
Yep. Yeah, listening is something. There's a great comic that I don't have in front of me, and I wish I had printed it out. But, you know, you'll see it hung up in a lot of different engineering offices or whatnot of any industry. And it's, you know, when you think of a tire swing, what do you think of? What do you think of when you think of a tire swing?
A rope with a tire.
A rope with a tire, right?
Yeah.
Sure. But the rope could be attached to one branch, or there could be two ropes going to two separate branches.
Oh. Or maybe the tire is vertical, or it's horizontal.
Or it's horizontal, right? Oh. And the comic that I always like to reference is, you know, it's what the engineer thought of, and it's this very complex tire swing. It's what, you know, somebody who might be good at marketing, right, wanted to sell, and it's this very shiny, very sleek tire swing. And at the end of the day, right, there's all these different, what we call perturbations, different comic panels. And at the end of the day, it's what the customer wanted. And it's just a rope, a branch, and a tire. But it's how do you, I think you got it exactly right. You know, listening to what's actually being asked and then trying to dissolve and discern what the real problem is. And then at that point, it's half solved. Half the work's done.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being with us, Anthony.
Jennifer, as always, that was amazing.
I know, right? Like, your job is to go out and try to get this flying car to fail. Isn't that cool? That's so fun.
Yeah, it's like a kid's dream come true. You get to break things.
Exactly. Well, for our listeners who are curious to find out which flying car Anthony worked on, please go to our website, solveitforkids.com, and click on the episode page for Anthony's episode, and you will see the picture of the flying car. I think there's a video there. And even if you do his challenge, which is to design and draw your own flying car, you could be entered to win a free book.
That's awesome. Books are so cool.
Books are cool. So if you want to do that, again, go to our website, solveforkids.com. And while you're there, don't forget to check out our teacher packs. We now have 3 of them. You can use our podcast in your classroom or homeschool.
Hey, Jennifer, you know, you are writing and designing books. Do you think it would help your books become better if you had someone try to break them before they were published?
Well, I wouldn't say break them, but we do have editors, so they look over everything we write to make sure it's proper. But you know, I think this is just the coolest thing. We're teaching kids about STEM, and STEM is everywhere.
Everywhere. And we are going to be right back here next week for another episode of Solve It for Kids.